From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Rex Tillerson is out as Secretary of State. President Trump has nominated CIA Director Mike Pompeo to replace him, Deputy Director Gina Haspel to replace Pompeo. MSNBC asked Lindsey Graham if he thought it was because Tillerson was tough on Russia.
I don't think Mike Pompeo's taken a back seat to anyone when it comes to Russia. Mike is very clear that Russians interfered in our elections and that the Russians are a bad actor. I don't think it has anything to do with that.
And the president spoke as he left the White House today.
Rex and I have been talking about this for a long time. We got along actually quite well, but we disagreed on things. When you look at the Iran deal, I think it's terrible. I guess it was okay.
Former Democratic Congresswoman Jane Harman heads the Wilson Center. Congresswoman, there's speculation Tillerson was fired Friday. Your thoughts?
Well, I think that Tillerson's an admirable man. He received an award from the Wilson Center before he became Secretary of State. I interviewed him here at the Wilson Center when he was Secretary of State. I think there are some accomplishments on his watch. Having said that, no one ever claimed that the chemistry between him and our commander-in-chief was good. It just wasn't. They were very different people. But I think the chemistry between Trump and Pompeo, at least as reported, is excellent. Pompeo brings very different experience. But I don't think Tillerson was told Friday, at least from what I hear. I think Trump made the decision Friday. I think Tillerson read Trump's Twitter account this morning.
Yeah, there are different reports. The Washington Post is saying that the president last Friday asked Tillerson to step aside. But as you say, there are now reports today that he saw about his firing in a Twitter. But you mentioned he'd done some things at the State Department. His critics have said he kind of decimated it, didn't replace jobs, was isolated. But you mentioned Pompeo. He has one of the closest relationships with President Trump. And yet, do you agree with Lindsey Graham that, as opposed to President Trump, Mike Pompeo is more muscular on Russia and its meddling in the election?
Yeah, I do agree with Lindsey. Pompeo has been CIA director for a year. He brings some skills to that post. I mean, he was number one in his class at West Point. He has a Harvard Law degree. He played some role, whether I agree with him or not, in investigating the Benghazi events. But at any rate, at the CIA, the workforce is not political. And the truth shall set you free is the mantra of the CIA. And they believe firmly that there was Russian involvement. Our entire intelligence community does. So Pompeo is the leader of that. Picked up that cause. And I think there's no question that that's what he believes. Trump doesn't stress that.
What do you make, though, of the fact that this comes a day after House Republicans on the committee to investigate Russian meddling closed their investigation? And we heard many of them say yesterday they think the CIA was wrong on Russia.
Yeah, well, that breaks my heart. I spent 8 years on the House Intelligence Committee, 4 as the senior Democrat, the ranking member on the committee, the role that Adam Schiff now has. And although there were disagreements from time to time, some of them very serious, we patched them over and we functioned as a committee. I think the committee is now broken, certainly for the near term, the next cycle, or maybe certainly as long as Donald Trump continues as president. And what happened yesterday, to the surprise of the Democrats, was the Republicans fell in line with Donald Trump's view about the lack of Russian meddling. So where you're going with this is, what's Pompeo now going to do
exactly
as Trump's appointee and loyal counselor? I think he'll have a difficult time breaking with the CIA view. I think he'll try to find a way forward that satisfies both his boss, that would be Trump, and his recent history. How he will do that will require some deftness.
Well, what do you think this says, that this firing and replacement comes just before the expected meeting with North Korea?
Well, I think that has a lot to do with it. I think that Trump wants good chemistry by his side, and that's what this appointment is. I don't know that he particularly values the State Department and what it contributes. I think he values what Mike Pompeo, who Mike Pompeo is and what he contributes.
One last question. He will be replaced, if confirmed, by his deputy, Gina Haspel, who oversaw the CIA's extraordinary rendition program. This was holding captured militants at so-called black sites. What do you make of her ascent? It's historic, first woman to head the CIA, but...
Yeah. And she's been the deputy before this. I think the hearings need to be careful. I lived this history, and I'm the one who then on the Intelligence Committee wrote a letter to the CIA General Counsel who had briefed me on the interrogation and asking him what policy guidance there was for the list of techniques that were used. I never got a substantive answer. My letter was classified. It's since been declassified, which is why I'm talking about it. But she was very involved in this. Mm. And I also urged them not to destroy videotapes, which I was told had been made, and they were destroyed, and she was part of that action. So I think she needs to be asked careful questions. Of course, it's good news that, and no surprise to me, that women are competent to head major intelligence agencies. But this part of her experience, I hope, will be carefully probed in her confirmation hearings.
Jane Harman, president of the Wilson Center, nine-term Democratic congresswoman from California. Congresswoman Harman, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, President Trump arrives in California today to see prototypes of a wall he wants built on the border with Mexico. Joining us now, John Sepulveda, who's host of the California Report on KQED. He's at the San Ysidro Port of Entry. John, talk about the significance of this visit. It's Trump's first as president to California.
Yeah, and it's taken a long time for him to get here. In fact, the longest it's ever taken a president is Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And back then you had to travel by train. And of course, FDR had polio, which made traveling more difficult for him. So there's a lot of significance in the fact that it's taken President Trump this long. And some of it's not surprising. I mean, President Trump has made it clear through his tweets and statements that he is not happy with California officials. In fact, he tweeted that California's sanctuary policies enable violent criminals to, quote, prey on innocent Americans. That's a fact that's widely disputed. And it's that kind of rhetoric that has really cast the president in a negative light here that has many people not happy with the president. His approval ratings hover somewhere around 33% in California. And of course, about 4.5 million more people in California voted for Hillary Clinton in the 2016 election. So he's just not a popular guy here. And he's made it clear before that he doesn't visit places where he doesn't feel like he's welcome.
The president's visit comes just a week after the attorney general, Jeff Sessions, was in California, and he announced a lawsuit against the state, accusing the state of not cooperating with federal immigration officials. Both Sessions and President Trump have repeatedly criticized the mayor of Oakland for giving warnings about imminent immigration arrests. How does all of that play into this visit?
Well, again, it just highlights the animosity between Trump and the state of California. You know, Mayor Libby Schaaf, Oakland Mayor Libby Schaaf, is not a darling of progressives. She's someone who, you know, would be 10 years ago talked about as being kind of this, you know, liberal center mayor, not somebody who's on the vanguard of progressive values. And yet she found herself thrust into a real kind of hero's circle with this stance of letting people know that this immigration raid was coming. And of course, for on the flip of it, for Attorney General Jeff Sessions and President Trump, they see this as akin to some type of treason, that the mayor's action essentially put, as they said, people in jeopardy, allowed hundreds of criminals to escape. Of course, that number is disputed, and my colleague at KQED, Julie Small, reported yesterday that an ICE spokesman, an Immigration Customs Enforcement spokesman, is actually resigning in part because he believes that President Trump's administration misled people on their response to what Mayor Schaaf said. So it's very interesting to watch this and know that these, again, are two oppositional political forces that really don't like each other.
The governor, Jerry Brown, sent a letter to President Trump inviting him to visit the high-speed rail line that's under construction in California. Is it likely that'll happen?
No, I was going to think of something funny to say, but there's nothing funny about this. I mean, the Central Valley is President Trump's base. You know, KQED, we've talked a lot to farmers who support President Trump, are upset with California. And he not only is he not going to the Central Valley, where, you know, he has a tremendous amount of support in this state, he's not going to Orange County for a fundraiser, which I was trying to figure out the last time a Republican president did not stop in Orange County. And I couldn't find it. I don't have a definitive answer. But just as a native Californian and someone who has watched Orange County begin the slow process of turning blue, it's quite the statement that the president of the United States, the Republican president, is not going to Orange County as kind of a bastion of strength. It represents the changes that have been happening here in California since about 1995.
He's also not going to Silicon Valley.
Yeah, and I don't think he would be welcome there. I mean, one of the things that has really kind of shown through largely is that President Trump's HB1 visa rollback has hurt Silicon Valley, according to Bloomberg analysts who say that a lot of those people who would be coming to Silicon Valley are now going to Canadian firms. So this is something that, you know, again, these immigration policies have a real effect on the economy of the state.
That's John Sepulvedo, who's host of the California Report on KQED, waiting for President Trump near the U.S. border there. John, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Almost every day, there's at least one story in the news that involves racism, sexism, or another kind of bigotry. But when you hear those stories, do you think, well, that's not me? Turns out, even among the best-intentioned people, unconscious biases can exist. So how can we identify these biases, and is it possible to overcome them? Joining us now is Patricia Devine, a professor of psychology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Professor, welcome to Here and Now.
Oh, thank you so much.
And if we were to ask somebody listening to this, are you racist? Are you sexist? I would assume the answer would be no. How often is that actually true?
I think you have to make a distinction between what people commit to in terms of their values. And I think when you think about people's values and whether they're committed to equality and trying to create opportunities for others, most Americans would say yes. Unfortunately, however, we also are prone to making snap judgments about other people, sort of spontaneous, default, quick assessments of others. And those tend not to comport with our values all the time. They tend to look more biased than our values do.
Like, give me an example of that.
Okay. So a student, former student of mine, was responding to an accident on campus. She went to render assistance to a student who was hit by a car. And simultaneously, another woman came to render assistance. This woman was barking commands. She was saying, don't move the head, call 911. And my student, who's very committed to addressing issues of sexism, looked up at her and earnestly said, are you a nurse? And you can imagine the woman's not a nurse. She was a doctor. But the nurse response is so easily provided by our socialization experiences, our learning histories, perhaps where when she was younger in particular, women were more likely to be nurses than physicians. But she knew from her own experience and her own beliefs that, of course, women could be doctors. Her own physician was a woman. And in that moment, she recognized that she fell prey to that kind of default habitual response that she disavows. She thinks it's wrong. She shouldn't have made that assumption. And yet in that moment, particularly under high arousal pressure, the stress of the accident, the easily supplied response was nurse. And so it's just that quick assumption that people make that will influence how they think about others, how they treat others, and as I said, the assumptions that they make that can diminish the experience of the other or could constrain their opportunities if you're not thinking that they're capable of doing a wide range of activities, for example.
And those biases are learned, right? I mean, how
very
and when do
so.
We learn these ideas about people?
They're very much learned. And the reality is that children already know the stereotypes attached to various groups by the time they're 4, 5, 6 years old. And so they know that women are caring and nurturing, for example, and emotional, and men are strong and decisive and independent. They know what the stereotypes are. And you get them from the media, from observations you make of others, sometimes from the direct or indirect messages you get from your parents, from teachers, from your peers. We're really inundated with these stereotype messages so that they're so well learned, they become firmly ingrained in your mind so that they get activated and you use them without even being aware of it or realizing it.
Now, there's a test, the implicit association test, which is part of Project Implicit at Harvard. How does that work?
Well, what this measure does is it helps to reveal the kinds of associations that you get from culture. So that if we take, for example, the women being caregivers and working, say, in the home and men being breadwinners and working in the workforce, you can measure these types of associations in this kind of – it's called a speeded dual categorization reaction task. And basically, it reveals how quickly you can link women with home and men with career. And you could do this for lots of groups. You could talk about race-related biases where white people are associated with good things, black people with bad things, and there are a variety of other implicit association tests. What these really reveal is the strength of those associations given to us by culture that create the challenge of trying to respond without bias, because the bias is the default, the spontaneous, the quickly activated.
Is it possible, if you discover that you do have biases, to truly change and unlearn them?
You can learn to address them. I'm not sure you unlearn them. For example, I reject notions of racial biases and gender biases, and yet I'm still very well aware of the stereotypes that are attached to these groups, and they get activated pretty quickly. But if you think about these as habits of mind, you can take steps like you would to break other habits to try to address them. And so you need to become motivated, and that's a personal decision, to try to overcome the kind of habitual response. You need to become aware of when it is that you display those types of responses, sort of tuning into when it is you're most vulnerable to showing bias. You have to have some strategies, some alternative responses that you could enact instead of the stereotypic bias, and then you have to work at it. You have to put some effort into it. But with the combination of motivation, awareness, strategies, and effort, you can learn to regulate the expression of these stereotypic biases.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Patricia Devine, who's a professor of psychology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And Professor, what about confronting other people about their biases? I was talking to a friend recently who said that he had a conversation with his father and said, "You're a racist and you're a sexist." And obviously, it was not a very comfortable conversation. And his right. father denied that it was true.
Right. Well, there are ways to confront or at least challenge the kind of assumptions that other people make. But I think calling them a racist and putting them on the defensive probably isn't the right strategy. And if you could point out that that was a stereotypic assumption that was made, you may or may not believe it. But when you make the assumption, it actually has consequences. I think that's something that's important to point out. But I think you have to guard against creating defensiveness.
How do you study this? Is there a scientific approach to studying prejudice?
Well, let's say, is there a scientific approach to studying how you could reduce these kinds of biases? Because you could take a scientific approach to really anything. But with regard to trying to reduce these biases, one of the things that I did with my colleagues was to try to develop an intervention built on this habit model that would train people to understand the origins of biases, the consequences of them, taught them strategies to try to address the bias using techniques like perspective taking, stereotype replacement, learning the individual qualities of others rather than jumping to stereotypic conclusions. And then we alerted them to the fact that you need to put some effort into this process. And we compared those people who we gave the training and the tools to those who had no such training. And then we followed them over time to find out if, in fact, their responses, their behaviors, their thoughts changed over time. And if you use the kind of method of making sure that people are equally likely to receive the training or be in a control group, we call it random assignment, then if there are differences in the sort of post period, we can be sure that those differences are because of the training. And we've observed a lot of important differences among our training participants, intervention participants, compared to those who were in a control condition. They become more concerned about discrimination as a social problem and motivated to address it. Because we've given them tools, they have a greater sense of what to do in response to the biases. They tune into, become more aware of when they show bias and when other people do. And we've shown in a variety of contexts that they actually engage in behaviors designed to try to reduce the bias in themselves and in others.
There may be some people who are listening to this saying, well, so what if I have some biases? As long as I am not hurting somebody else, can't I believe whatever I want?
Sure, people can believe what they want, but the question is whether what you believe or even what you don't intend to do, so this spontaneous, unintentional activation of biases, may actually lead to outcomes that are discriminatory, unfair. And in that regard, if you're constraining the opportunities of others, diminishing other people's experience, then it might be a bias about which you could become concerned and might want to address.
When you look at the country overall right now, do you think we're getting better on this issue or not?
That's a great question, because we're having a challenging time right now. Since the election in 2016, there seems to be a shift in what is normatively acceptable, at least in some circles. I think there's been an unleashing of incivility and hostility in social media and other forums. But what I've been heartened by is the enduring commitment in many organizations that I've had the fortune to visit, where they stay committed to trying to create equality for all of their, whether it's students in the university context or whether we're talking about employees in law firms and tech industries, the commitment to try to create circumstances where people can thrive in those contexts unencumbered by bias seems very strong to me. And so I think we're persisting in those efforts against a backdrop of some unfortunate shifts.
Do you see any bias in your own thoughts?
Sure. I mean, I have to work at them just like everybody else does, right? I mean, there are times where gender or race biases might pop to mind, but I've become more efficient at spotting them, and I've become more efficient at stopping them and replacing them with responses that are more consistent with my values. I mean, this learning history that we have with these biases, it starts very young, and it doesn't really go away. I mean, look at advertising in our contemporary culture. Look at the media, whether you look at movie roles that portray characters in stereotypic ways or television characters. I mean, we're still inundated or bombarded with these images. And so it's sort of an ongoing process to become effective at regulating the expression of bias.
That's Patricia Devine, who's a professor of psychology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Very interesting. Professor, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The noted conductor James Levine has been fired by the Metropolitan Opera over accusations of sexual abuse and harassment. Similar allegations against former Royal Philharmonic conductor Charles Dutoit have put classical music radio programmers in a bind. David C. Barnett of WCPN IdeaStream reports stations across the country are divided over how to react.
Next, music from Act One of Verdi's Falstaff, the great honor monologues.
WCLV program director Bill O'Connell has queued up a rousing opera excerpt for his listeners in Cleveland.
Here's Bryn Terrible with the Met Orchestra.
Hey, Pancho! And that impediment!
But he doesn't mention that this popular recording was conducted by James Levine. References to Levine and his music are nearly gone from the Cleveland station following allegations of sexual abuse with music students dating back to the 1960s. WCLV station manager Jenny Northern says they also avoid conductor Charles Dutoit after a number of sexual assault allegations against him.
We are suspending broadcasting their works for the most part, and we're trying to see what happens. Is there due process? What's the situation?
Joe Goetz is also grappling with this as music director of WFIU in Bloomington, Indiana.
There has been a very big buzz in internet chat circles.
Goetz recalls the controversy erupted less than 2 hours after Levine wrapped up a prominent live performance on the Metropolitan Opera's season opener last December. Radio station peers around the country immediately weighed in.
Responses varied quite widely, from people who were out and out shunning Levine completely to people who said, well, maybe we'll still play his recordings but not mention that he's the conductor, to people who said, well, how can you possibly erase an incredible career's worth of music?
The allegations against Charles Dutoit hit close to home for this Indiana station. One of his accusers, award-winning soprano Sylvia McNair, was a longtime teacher on the Bloomington campus.
She's still a very active member of the music community here, and it would have been a real slap, I think, in her face to continue to feature his recordings given what he allegedly did to her.
But not all broadcasters agree. James Real is classical music director of Arizona Public Media in Tucson.
I have not made any changes to my schedules as a result of the scandals, and I am continuing to play the recordings of guys like James Levine on a regular basis, and I've received not one comment from a listener, pro or con.
And he adds there's nothing that compels him morally or legally to do otherwise.
I'm not their jury, and nothing I can do could have a direct, meaningful effect on them. All that's left is blacklisting, really.
However things shake out, WCLV manager Jenny Northern in Cleveland worries that something's been lost.
I do think people turn to classical music just because it is a place that doesn't often show an ugly side. It's sad.
For Joe Goetz in Indiana, the recently exposed ugly side has led to something more positive.
It's really given me the chance to explore other lesser-known recordings that I might have overlooked before. And I think that's actually a good thing, to not always lean on the crutches of these, you know, monumental, well-recorded conductors.
For instance, he uses this recording of Saint-Saëns' Danse Bacchanale, conducted by Eiji Owe, as a substitute for a similar performance by Charles Dutoit. And that ushers in an opportunity for different conductors to be heard.
David C. Barnett in Cleveland.
So the face of the U.S. to the world changes soon from Rex Tillerson as Secretary of State to possibly President Trump's nominee, CIA Director Mike Pompeo, who will likely continue Trump's America First pledge. Then there's Italy, which just held an election in which nationalists made strides. Britain voted to exit from the EU. What does this wave of isolationism, this withdrawal, mean for global health? The Trump administration has proposed eliminating $2 billion of global health funding, which would affect HIV and tuberculosis treatment, reproductive health, maternal mortality. Lori Garrett, a former senior fellow for global health on the Council on Foreign Relations, says the line from politics to policy to public health is clear. Lori, welcome back.
Thank you.
Well, we'll talk a little bit about the opposite. What has globalization done for public health?
From the very beginning, global health and, to a lesser degree, development hitched their wagons to globalization. And you saw a lot of the most important trends in global health, particularly this huge surge in financial support tied to the kind of globalization institutions like the World Economic Forum, the G7, the G20, all the big, multinational efforts, and tied to bringing the Fortune 500 corporations on board. So from the very beginning, global health benefited from the expansion of globalization writ large.
Was that because once countries are more involved in investing in other countries or have more trade with other countries or more businesses are involved with other countries, they're more concerned or even aware of the global health issues?
That's a small part of it, that the private sector became more aligned with the effort. But the real big change, the huge shift was that globalization brought a lot of movement of resources and money around the world just because trade changed. You know, borders opened, trade restrictions, tariffs, all of that came down. And as a result, there was a sense of the flow of capital and a certain kind of obligation that went with that flow of capital, meaning that, as President George Bush famously put it when he announced the creation of PEPFAR, the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, the world's largest single disease-focused global health effort in history. When he announced that, he referred to the Bible and said, "Those to whom much is given, much is expected."
Well, now you say, and we can see, trends of isolationism, nationalism here in the U.S., the Trump administration cutting back monies spent on global health. Give us some examples of how you see that playing out.
Oh, there's so many things going on that are disturbing at the moment, and it's not just the United States. If it was, you know, that would be hard enough. But in fact, we see a reversal trend from many parts of the world. First of all, you have to understand the degree to which this whole exercise of what we call global health had become dependent on American money from two key sources, the U.S. government and Bill and Melinda Gates. If you add in DFID, which is the British Foreign Aid Program, then those are the big three responsible for more than 60% of what we call global health money, going to a variety of different programs from the World Health Organization to specific HIV programs and so on. And, you know, that meant that the whole world had suddenly become incredibly dependent on just three sources of money. And I had been warning for a very long time that this was incredibly dangerous and that there might be a political moment when the United States government would shift or the British government would shift or Bill Gates would wake up one morning and say, you know what? I'm fed up with global health. I'm moving on to climate change. Well, that moment has now come. We're now facing shifting tides politically in those funding spaces.
Well, what do you see? Be specific. What do you see as the main health threats?
Well, I think the most serious concern at the moment is about HIV/AIDS, because what happened starting once PEPFAR rolled out in 2003, so in the last 15 years, has been a recognition that if you can get a person appropriately treated on medication that keeps their amount of virus in their body down low, they're very unlikely to transmit virus to their sexual or drug use partners. So by treating the global population of HIV-positive people, we lower the possibility of the spread of the disease largely. And so the mission of this global exercise has been to get the entire HIV-positive population, no matter how remote, no matter how poor, into lifelong therapy to control their viral load and limit their possibility of being contagious to their partners. Add to it, the clock is ticking loudly because more and more of the new HIV infections out there involve drug-resistant strains that cannot be treated with the cheap first-line medicines. And now we're up to 10% of all new infections in the world are drug-resistant. So our window for accomplishing this control of the global pandemic is narrowing. Well, unfortunately, we've only managed to get about half of the global population on these drugs. We still have another 19 million people to reach and treat. And at that moment, when we're at that juncture, we see a sudden decline in commitments and investments. And if the Trump proposed budget for FY 2019 is actually enacted by Congress, we would see a dramatic reduction in U.S. commitment to all aspects of both domestic and foreign HIV surveillance, testing, and treatment.
Well, so what would you like to see to offset that isolationist thinking? And do you worry that it might take some kind of outbreak to convince people that nations should cooperate?
If we wait for an outbreak to take action, we'll be in the same lousy shape we were in 2014 when Ebola broke out in three countries at once. And thousands of people needlessly perished, and the whole global economy was disrupted. No, we can't continue to have a situation where urgency in global health only arises when we're in the midst of a terrible epidemic. But by the way, Robin, we're in a lot of epidemics right now. They may not be headlines in the consciousness of the average American or the average listener to this show, but we're out of yellow fever vaccine pretty much everywhere in the world, including in the United States, because there have been so many outbreaks of yellow fever and now a big crisis of yellow fever in Brazil. We have a real crisis with cholera, more than a million cases already in Yemen and spreading all across the African continent right now. And then, of course, we are coming out of, fortunately, the back end now, I think, finally, of a very big flu epidemic that spread and caused record levels of infection and hospitalization in many countries and in many parts of the United States. So, you know, what is it we're waiting for? How big does this next pandemic have to be? How lethal? How many millions of people and billions of dollars before we see the kind of action that is lasting and that creates some coherence across nations and shakes people out of this isolationism?
That's Lori Garrett, the former senior fellow for global health on the Council on Foreign Relations, who has frequently sounded the alarm on global health issues. And this time it's how she sees the rise of nationalism affecting global health. Lori, thanks as always.
Thank you.
And by the way, Lori mentioned Bill Gates might wake up one day and decide he's moved on from global health to climate change. Well, that has not happened. Gates is still funding health initiatives worldwide, despite feeling disappointed by President Trump's proposed cuts. And this note, federal investigators are looking into Sunday's helicopter crash into New York's East River, which is drawing attention to a popular trend in this age of Instagram. The passengers were all harnessed to the floor to take pictures while hanging out the doorless chopper. Reportedly, they'd watched a short video. They had a knife to cut the harnesses, but there are questions as to whether that is enough training. All five passengers died. All were under 35.
President Trump has blocked a $117 billion takeover of the chipmaker Qualcomm. In an executive order, Trump said the acquisition by the Singapore-based company Broadcom raised significant threats to national security. Had it gone through, it would have been the largest tech deal in history. Here to talk about that and more is our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Ed Lee is managing editor at Recode. He joins us from New York. Hi, Ed.
Hey.
And let's start with the players here. For people who don't know, what is Broadcom, first of all?
Broadcom is a chip maker. They're based in Singapore. And, you know, they've been on an acquisition spree of late, and one of which was they were trying to buy Qualcomm.
Which is also a chip maker.
Also a chip maker. And both companies specifically make chips for mobile phones or mobile devices generally, which is sort of the booming sector of tech right now.
So why did Broadcom want Qualcomm?
Well, it's got a growing business, and if you've got, you know, if you're a cell phone, if you have a cell phone, chances are part of the fee of what you paid for that went to Qualcomm. They've got this great royalty business on patents that they own. So it's a good business to own in terms of, you know, the future of mobile, where it's headed.
And Qualcomm is also a key player in the push to 5G mobile networks, which is the next generation of how we'll transmit data, right?
Right. And 5G is sort of crucial for how, you know, not just for, you know, tech, but just everything. Could be, you know, self-driving cars, could be just for government use as well in terms of, you know, where everything's headed. So the guts of the system are all sort of this budding wireless technology. And I think that's key to how the future of the country is going to run, how the future of businesses are going to run.
So what exactly did President Trump say in his executive order blocking the deal?
Well, it was based on national security interests, and it was specifically about 5G, as we talked about a second ago. Qualcomm is one of the leaders in that space in the development of 5G technology. The concern was that if Broadcom was allowed to buy Qualcomm, that it would pull back R&D investment into 5G, which then would sort of make the U.S. less competitive, specifically against, you know, companies like China and Russia and other parts of the world where, again, this will be the sort of the future of how everything will run.
This is very unusual, though, for the president to step in and stop a deal like this, even though this is a huge deal.
It's a massive. It would have been the largest technology merger of all time, $117 billion. Yeah. And the way in which they did it is unusual. I mean, they did a review prior to an actual deal taking place, for one thing. That was one part of it. But the other part that was unusual is how they got into sort of making this determination. Broadcom is based in Singapore, and Singapore is not China, so that should be clear. But what the determination they're making isn't so much that it was Singapore owning a U.S. company, but a company that's used to cutting back on resources when they acquire other companies. Hmm. What they're effectively saying is we just don't like how you run businesses more so than you present a threat to national security by owning the company. So they took a few leaps to get there. And it was an unusual determination, for sure.
So does this mean that this is the end of the deal, or is there a way it could still be revived?
there's very little recourse for Broadcom now. That is, at least if it wants to buy Qualcomm. There could buy other companies. There are other things potentially for sale. And then Qualcomm itself has been given a bit of a reprieve, you know, that this was seen – this was a hostile takeover. So in a way, the government acted on its behalf here.
We also have an acquisition that actually did go through. Yesterday, Apple announced that it's going to acquire Next Issue Media and its digital magazine subscription service, Texture, that affects magazines like The Atlantic, Vanity Fair, Time. What's the significance of this deal?
So, Texture, the app, is sort of seen as sort of a Netflix or a Hulu for magazines. You're paying a monthly fee for which you can eat all you want in terms of the types of content available to you. And the content that's applied are, you know, coming from professional publishers like Time Inc. and Condé Nast and The Atlantic. So it's good stuff. I think the big signal here is that Apple is basically investing in news, though the terms of the deal were not disclosed. We can't imagine it's a ton of money.
Is it possible that this would have a major impact on the magazine industry, which obviously has been struggling?
I think it'll have a minimal impact, if anything. Again, it seems like Apple's sort of dipping its toes in the water. I think it's more of a political signal almost. It's basically saying, you know, there's all been fake news issues out there with Facebook and Google. We don't have that problem. And here's another example of how we're sort of bolstering professional news and not just sort of this user-generated stuff, the viral sharing of who knows what out there. And I think that's the significance of what this deal is.
Ed, as we're talking, the president of the United States is in California. It's his first visit there as president. He is not going to Silicon Valley. And meanwhile, Apple's CEO Tim Cook is in Washington meeting on Capitol Hill.
The Silicon Valley is certainly not friendly to President Trump, and I guess vice versa as well. Silicon Valley is noted for being this sort of democratic stronghold and very sort of libertarian as well as liberal values. And I think that's very much at odds with how the Trump administration has been managing the country and certainly the things that Trump has been saying. The irony, of course, is that Trump himself is seen as sort of the first Twitter president.
Right.
Able to get his voice out there through social media in a way that other presidents never have before. So I think, you know, the irony certainly is deep on that.
That's Ed Lee, managing editor at Recode. Ed, thank you.
Anytime.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.